A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Herman's taking a moment. That's fine. Good architecture handles a node going briefly quiet. We'll carry the thread and he can rejoin when he's ready. So Daniel sent us this one. He's been rebuilding a home server after a cascade of hardware failures. First the drive, then the replacement drive was DOA. Then the power supply started making sounds no electronic device should ever make. And the experience crystallized something for him. The more components he replaced, the more he realized that trying to prevent data loss at the hardware level, RAID, redundant power supplies, ECC memory, is fundamentally a game you can't win, because the failure surface is basically infinite. And here's the pivot that makes this a My Weird Prompts episode. He sees a distant but almost perfect parallel between that problem and the survival of Jewish religious texts across 2.5 millennia. Specifically, he points to Ezra the scribe, not just for codifying the Torah, but for establishing a distributed network of local scribes that ensured no single destruction event could ever eliminate the text. In the pre-computing era, this was the essential data of a religion, and the system worked. So the question is, if we analyze Ezra's project as a modern systems architect would, what did he actually build, and what does it teach us about backup strategies we're still getting wrong?
I'm back. Thanks for holding. And I love this framing. It lands at exactly the right moment for me. I've been reading through the USENIX FAST 2024 proceedings, and there's a paper in there that makes Daniel's point from the hardware side with genuinely sobering data. They analyzed enterprise data loss events across multiple organizations and years, and found 12% of catastrophic losses involved multiple simultaneous hardware failures. Not sequential, not the classic drive fails, you replace it, rebuild completes, another drive fails later. Pattern that RAID is designed to survive. Redundancy schemes got defeated because they were never designed for correlated failure modes. One case they documented, a PSU ripple took out 3 drives in the same array within milliseconds. The voltage fluctuation propagated across the shared power rail, and 3 drives interpreted the ripple as a fatal error condition simultaneously. In another case, a RAID controller's firmware had a bug that surfaced specifically during the high IIO stress of a rebuild operation. The controller had a latent kernel panic trigger, and the hot spare was on the same power rail as the degraded array. Everything spiked, everything went. Stack more hardware, you stack more interdependencies, which means you stack more failure pattern. I think the prompt is fundamentally right before we even get to Ezra. Hardware level mitigation alone is a losing gambit.
Of course it is. Every layer you add is another thing that can break. It's like building a chair with 16 legs so no single leg failure drops you, and then discovering the floor just collapsed. That's hardware redundancy in a sentence. But I want to push on the simultaneous failure point for a second. How does that actually present to the administrator? Because I think most people imagine a failure as something that announces itself. You get the warning light, the smart alert, the email from your monitoring system saying, hey, drive 3 is looking a little soose. And you have time to react.
That's the terrifying part. In several of the cases they studied, the simultaneous failures presented as a system that was running normally one moment and was simply gone the next. No smart warnings, no predictive failure indicators, no graceful degradation. The first indication of trouble was a kernel panic or a file system that wouldn't mount. And the post-mortem analysis, which in some cases took weeks, revealed that multiple components had failed within the same sub-second window. The operators initially assumed it had to be a software bug or a kernel regression, because what are the odds of 3 drives failing at once? But the odds change when the failures share a root cause. That PSU ripple is a single event with multiple victims. And here's the thing that keeps me up. The operators spent weeks chasing the wrong diagnosis. They were bisecting kernel versions, rolling back driver updates, swapping out memory DIMMs one at a time, because the idea that three drives failed simultaneously was so statistically implausible under the independence assumption that they ruled it out a priori. And they were wrong.
The failure surface isn't just large. It's interconnected in ways that defeat our assumptions about independence. And those assumptions run deep. They're baked into how we calculate reliability, how we size our redundancy, how we explain to management why the budget request says 16 drives. Let me enumerate this properly, because I think it's worth really staring at what we're asking hardware to handle. On a modern home server or a small data center box, you've got at least 8 distinct points of hardware failure, and I'm not even counting rare edge cases. First, RAM, and I mean even ECC RAM. ECC corrects single-bit errors, but multi-bit errors happen, especially with aging DIMMs, and those can silently corrupt data before the OS ever knows. Second, SSD NANDware. The controller might report healthy until its write endurance is exhausted, then it just stops, and in some consumer firmware implementations it goes read-only without warning. Third, hard drive head crash. Mechanical, catastrophic, instantaneous. Fourth, PSU voltage sag. A power supply that's deteriorating can produce ripple noise, and that ripple gets through to the SAS controller or the drive's onboard electronics. Fifth, motherboard capacitor aging. Over 5 to 7 years, electrolytic capacitors bulge, ESR rises, voltage regulation becomes unstable, and you get intermittent errors that no diagnostic catches. Sixth, NIC packet corruption. A failing network interface can introduce silent data corruption in packets traversing a NAS, and TCP checksums are only 16 bits, so the undetected error rate is measurable. 7th, RAID controller firmware bugs. These are computers running their own OS. They have bugs. The 2011 RAID 5 write hole is the classic case. And 8th, UPS battery failure. The one component people forget to test, it passes its self-check for years, then power fails, and the UPS dies before the machine can shut down cleanly. All of these can write garbage to disk. RAID mirrors that garbage lovingly across every drive.
4 seconds to enumerate, and the RAAA RAID 5 write hole is worth pausing on. That's where the RAAAAA controller loses power mid-write. The parity block doesn't match the data blocks, and the array never knows until you try to rebuild. So you have drives that all look healthy, a RAID array reporting normal, and data that's already gone. I'd add a 9th failure point because you mentioned SSDs, the trim bug that affected certain Samsung firmware revisions around 2015. Drives would return garbage on read for blocks that had been trimmed but not yet physically erased, effectively lying to the file system about what was stored. Any journaling file system would propagate the garbage as if it were valid data. And what's insidious about that class of bug is that it's not a hardware failure in the traditional sense. The drive is functioning exactly as designed, the firmware just has a logic error that corrupts data under specific, hard-to-reproduce conditions. You can't detect it by looking at smart stats. You can't detect it by watching for reallocated sectors. You only find it when you try to read a file and get back something that isn't your file.
Excellent addition, and that trim bug is a perfect example of something I want to emphasize. These aren't independent probabilities. The failure surface interacts in ways that formal risk models rarely capture. Back to the 2024 US Enix paper. In 17% of their studied multi-failure events, the initial failure actually stressed the remaining components in a way that accelerated the second failure. A drive dies. The RAID controller spikes CPU during rebuild to recalculate parity. The extra thermal load pushes a marginal capacitor over the threshold. The power rail destabilizes. A second drive starts producing corrupted writes. The redundancy scheme didn't just fail to prevent the cascade, it amplified it. The rebuild process itself became the vector for the second failure. It's like a hospital where the fire suppression system accidentally floods the ICU. The thing you installed to save you is now the thing killing you. That's almost perverse. The thing you built to protect against failure becomes the mechanism by which failure propagates. But here's the part I think most coverage misses, and it connects directly to Daniel's point about data-level versus hardware-level thinking. ZFS scrub corruption incidents in 2023 demonstrated that even copy-on-write file systems with checksums can fail if the hardware provides consistently bad data. A failing SAS expander was sending corrupted writes to multiple drives in a ZFS pool, and because the pool accepted the corrupted data as valid data, complete with freshly calculated checksums for the corrupted content, the scrubs returned clean. The corruption was baked into the checksum tree. The only recovery was a full restore from backup, and if your backup lived on the same sand fabric, you were in trouble. Which brings me to a question. How many people actually test whether their backup target is on the same failure domain as their primary storage? Because I think the answer is almost nobody.
Almost nobody, and that's the exact point where the Ezra parallel becomes operational rather than metaphorical. So let me define the distinction carefully, because it's where the whole argument lives. A system-level backup captures the state of a machine, its file system, its configuration, its installed packages. You restore it to similar hardware or a VM, and you're back up. But the unit of preservation is still the system. A data-level backup treats the data as the primary artifact and the hardware as disposable. You're backing up specific files, databases, repositories, the information content independent of any particular machine. If every computer you own simultaneously catches fire, you buy new hardware and pull the data back in. That's what data level means in practice. The data has an existence independent of any storage medium or host system. And I want to be really clear about why this distinction matters. A system-level backup to an external USB drive sitting on the same desk as your server is not a backup in the Ezra sense. It's a hardware proximate copy that shares a fire zone, a power grid, a theft surface, and quite possibly a fate. If your apartment floods, you lose both copies. If someone breaks in and steals the server, they're probably taking the external drive too. You've protected against exactly one failure pattern, the primary drive dying of natural causes, and you've left every other failure pattern completely unaddressed.
I think most people hear backup and think it means a system-level image on an external drive, which is a start, but it's still hardware-coupled thinking. You're still treating the storage medium as part of the preservation strategy, rather than as a disposable carrier. It's the difference between making a photocopy of a document and leaving it in the same filing cabinet versus sending a copy to a colleague in another city. One of those survives a building fire. The other doesn't.
Now, here's the historical parallel. No one understood this better than Ezra, circa 458 BCE, under Artaxerxes I of Persia. He arrives in Jerusalem, finds the community in disarray, people intermarrying with surrounding peoples who don't share the covenantal framework, and the Torah, the governing text, is both poorly disseminated and unevenly observed. He codified it, yes, but the Revolutionary Act wasn't editorial, it was architectural.
I've heard you call Ezra a systems architect before, and I want the specifics. What did he actually build, as opposed to just codify? Because codified the Torah is the part everyone knows. That's the Sunday school version. What's the infrastructure underneath that?
He established, and this was a deliberate administrative act, under Persian imperial authority, which gave him the legal and political backing to make it stick, a system of local scribes in every Jewish settlement across the breadth of the empire, from Babylon to Jerusalem and into the diaspora communities throughout the Persian satrapies. Each scribe maintained their own complete copy of the Torah. This wasn't gentle encouragement. It would be nice if every community had a scroll. This was institutional structure with teeth. The scribes were trained through a standardized curriculum. They were credentialed. You couldn't just declare yourself a scribe and start copying, and most importantly, they were local. No single fire, no single invading army, no single edict from a hostile ruler could reach all the copies. He created what we would now call a peer-to-peer replication network with full geographic distribution. Every node carried the entire dataset. Every node was operationally independent. These scribes weren't syncing to a central server. They weren't checking in with Jerusalem for the latest patches. Each community could continue reading, interpreting, and transmitting the text even if every other community went dark. That's not a distributed system with a control plane, that's a decentralized network where every node is a full peer.
A peer-to-peer replication network with full geographic distribution. The original BitTorrent swarm with eternal seeding.
I can't tell if that's a joke or a good analogy.
It's both, and dead serious. If you think about what makes BitTorrent resilient, it's that nobody controls the tracker in a truly distributed swarm, and any single peer can vanish and the data remains available as long as sufficient copies exist. The node count is the resilience factor. But here's what I think the average person doesn't grasp about Ezra's project. In 458 BCE, each node was expensive. You needed a trained scribe, which meant years of education. You needed writing materials, parchment or papyrus, ink, proper storage. You needed time, because copying a Torah scroll by hand takes months of full-time work. The marginal cost of adding a node was high. And yet it was still worth it, because the catastrophic destruction scenario wasn't an edge case. It was a recurring feature of history. These people had seen the Babylonian exile. They knew what it meant to have the temple destroyed and the community scattered. They were designing for a threat model that had already materialized once in living cultural memory. That's not paranoia. That's engineering based on empirical data.
The recurring feature needs to be underscored here, because it's what makes the architecture rational rather than paranoid. In 167 BCE, Antiochus IV Epiphanes issued his decrees. He outlawed Torah observance, and he burned every Hebrew scroll he could find. This was a targeted data destruction attack. Find the copies, destroy them. Ransomware, but by fire. In 70 CE, the Romans sacked Jerusalem, destroyed the Second Temple, and burned whatever texts were housed there. That was a site-level catastrophic failure. If these events had happened against a single central repository, the dataset would be gone. The Library of Alexandria model, which, by the way, is the counterexample here, one building, however many copies of scrolls inside it, and it burned and they were gone. And we still mourn that loss precisely because it was centralized. All the eggs, one basket, one fire. But Ezra had architected a network where even the destruction of the primary node, Jerusalem, the temple, the likely canonical scrolls, couldn't take down the data.
Because there was no canonical copy anymore. That's the inversion that's so elegant. Once you have 50 independent nodes, each with a verified complete copy, the concept of a master copy becomes meaningless. Every node is authoritative. Destroy the original, and the data is still distributed. The network is the archive. And this flips something in how we think about backup hierarchies. We're so accustomed to primary and secondary copies, production and backup, that we forget you can design a system with no primary at all. Every copy is a peer. And I think that's counterintuitive for most people, because we're trained to think in hierarchies. There's the original file, and then there are backups of the original. But Ezra's system says no, there are only copies. Some are older, some are newer, but none of them is the copy that the others depend on. The loss of any one scroll is a sadness, not a catastrophe.
And the protocols he established are startling to modern eyes. Scribes were required to copy from a written source, not from memory. That's write-ahead logging in database terms. You don't reconstruct from what you remember. You read from a verified source and reproduce exactly. The Torah scroll had to match a verified exemplar. After copying, the scribe's work was checked with methods that included counting every single letter. Literally, a manual checksum. There were even designated correctors, the Magihim, whose entire role was to compare newer copies against older authoritative ones and fix discrepancies. That's a scrub operation. You have a dedicated process whose job is to walk the dataset, compare it bit by bit, or letter by letter, against a known good copy, and correct any drift. And the Magihim weren't an afterthought. They weren't volunteers who showed up when they had spare time. This was an institutional role with defined responsibilities and, as far as we can tell from the historical record, genuine authority. If a Magish found an error, the scroll was corrected or, in cases of irreparable error, removed from circulation. That's a failed drive being pulled from the array.
Counting every letter on the scroll is roughly equivalent to a SHA-256 hash verification, where you're doing it by hand, and it takes weeks. And the fact that this was considered non-negotiable overhead. That's the part I think lands hardest for modern practitioners. Error correction wasn't an afterthought bolted onto the copying process. It was the most carefully designed part of the system. How many of us run backups and never verify them? How many RAID arrays go years without a scrub? I know people who had backup scripts that have been running silently for years, generating terabytes of backup data, and they've never once tried to restore a file from them. They're operating on faith.
The verification gap is real. I've seen surveys suggesting that something like 30 to 40% of small business backups have never been test restored. They're running the backup process, they're generating the files, but they've never actually confirmed that the data can come back. Ezra's scribes verified every single copy, letter by letter, before it was considered valid. The verification was the process. Another protocol that jumps out, the practice of comparing scrolls during pilgrimage festivals when communities from across the diaspora came to Jerusalem. That's periodic reconciliation across independently maintained nodes. It's very close to what we now call quorum-based consensus checking. Each community brought its Torah scroll. They'd be read publicly and compared. Discrepancies were noted and investigated. The network self-corrected over geographic distance and political fragmentation. And here's what's remarkable. This worked even when the communities had been separated for generations, even when they had developed different interpretive traditions, even when they were living under different political regimes with different levels of religious freedom. The data reconciliation process transcended all of that. The text was the common ground.
Which means the system had version control baked in, operating over centuries. That's not accidental artifact survival, that's engineered resilience. And I think the misconception is worth flagging here. Most people assume ancient text preservation was passive. You put scrolls in a jar somewhere, you hide them in a cave, and you hope they survived. But the Jewish scribal tradition was not passive. It was tireless, rigorous, and sometimes I think the intensity with which error checking was done exceeds what we see in plenty of modern backup operations. There's a related example I want to bring in, the Cairo Geniza.
Yes, let's go there, because the Geniza is the accidental proof of concept. But before we do, I want to ask the question that flows naturally backward through this history. We keep saying that extra hardware introduces new failure pattern, that stacking more metal doesn't solve the problem. Can we point to a specific historical case where the distributed copy model demonstrably outperformed a targeted destruction attack? Because I think having a concrete example from the modern era makes the Ezra parallel feel less abstract. We've got Antiochus, we've got Rome, those are ancient. What does this look like in a world with printing presses and modern state apparatus?
The Nazi book burnings, May 10, 1933. Oppenplatz in Berlin, estimated 25,000 books destroyed in a single night. University students seized university and public libraries, torched works on a massive pyre, and there's film footage of it. Hebrew texts were specifically targeted. Rare scroll collections, theological works, anything identified as Jewish intellectual production. They burned them in front of a cheering crowd. And yet the text survived. Because by 1933, the Jewish textual tradition had been distributed across diaspora communities for centuries. Printed copies existed on every continent. No single fire, no matter how symbolically charged, could reach all the copies. The network outperformed the attack. That's the N+1 resilience principle playing out in real history. And what strikes me about this example is that the attackers understood exactly what they were trying to destroy. This wasn't random vandalism. This was a calculated assault on cultural memory, carried out by a regime that was methodical, well-resourced, and utterly committed. And it still failed, because the architecture of distribution had already won.
That's a powerful example. The attackers had the will, the organization, and the fire, and they still couldn't delete the data, because the data didn't live in one place. It lived everywhere. And that brings us to the Cairo Geniza, which is the accidental demonstration of how distributed preservation creates resilience even without active intent. A Geniza is a storage area in a synagogue where worn-out texts bearing God's name are placed because they can't be casually discarded. The Cairo Geniza, in the Ben Ezra Synagogue in Fustat, what's now Old Cairo, had been accumulating material since the 9th century. When scholars gained access in the 1890s, they found over 300,000 separate fragments. Not just Bible portions, contracts, receipts, prescriptions, letters, court documents, children's writing exercises. An entire cross-section of medieval Jewish life, preserved not because anyone designed it as an archive, but because the distributed practice of maintaining texts in multiple communities meant that even the discards from one synagogue constituted a comprehensive library. The Geniza is what happens when you have so many copies in so many places that even the trash becomes an archive. That's resilience at a level no one planned for.
This maps beautifully onto the Loxess model. Lots of copies keep stuff safe, which Stanford launched in 1999 to address the problem of academic journals vanishing when publishers went under or moved behind paywalls. The insight was that if enough libraries each maintain a copy of a journal, no single publisher bankruptcy or access policy change can eliminate it. Currently, it's stabilizing something like 10,000 journal titles in distributed form. The pattern is identical. Reproduction across many places, not many mirrors in one place. The Cairo Geniza was an accidental LOSOC-SS network running for 1,000 years. And I love the accidental quality of it, because it suggests something important. If you build a system with enough distribution, resilience becomes an emergent property, rather than something you have to explicitly engineer at every layer. You don't have to plan for every threat. You just have to make sure no single threat can reach all the copies.
The Geniza also demonstrates something about geographic distribution that's easy to overlook. The fragments survive not just because there were many copies, but because the copies were in different political jurisdictions, different climate zones, different threat environments. A fire in Cairo couldn't reach the copies in Aleppo. A flood in Aleppo couldn't reach the copies in Fez. The distribution wasn't just numerical, it was geopolitical. Your data needs to run across boundaries that a single disaster, natural, political, or economic, can't cross. And I want to push on this because I think it's the part of the Ezra model that modern practitioners resist most. It's easy to say, I'll put a backup at my parents' house, or I'll use a cloud provider. But are your parents in the same floodplain? Is your cloud provider's US East 1 region in the same hurricane zone as your house? These are not hypothetical questions. We've seen multiple cloud region outages caused by cooling failures during heat waves that affected entire geographic areas. If your primary storage and your backup are both in the path of the same weather system, you don't have geographic distribution. You have geographic co-location with extra steps.
Let me pull this together into something actionable, because Daniel's prompt isn't just a history lesson. If we take Ezra's architecture seriously as a design pattern, what does it actually prescribe for someone running a home server or a small business NAS today? I think it prescribes at least 4 things. 1. Treat your data as the primary artifact and your hardware as disposable. If you can't restore your data to entirely new hardware from a completely different vendor, you don't have a backup. You have a hardware-dependent state snapshot. 2. Geographic distribution isn't optional. An external drive on the same disk isn't a backup. It's a slightly delayed mirror that shares a power grid, a fire zone, and a theft surface with your primary storage. 3. Verification is part of the backup process, not an optional follow-up. If you haven't test-restored your data, you don't know you have it. And 4. The number of independent copies matters more than the reliability of any single copy. 3 cheap copies in 3 locations beat 1 expensive copy in 1 location every time.
I'd add a 5th, which comes directly from the scribal verification protocols. Your copies need to be compared against each other periodically. Bit rot happens. File system corruption happens. If you have 3 copies and never compare them, you might have 3 copies that all silently degraded in different ways, and you won't know which one is correct, or if any of them are. The scribes solve this by bringing scrolls together at festivals and comparing them. The modern equivalent is checksum-based integrity verification run regularly across all copies, with a mechanism to flag discrepancies and a policy for resolving them. That's the scrub operation, and it's the difference between having copies and having a self-correcting system. A copy you never verify is a copy you're trusting on faith, and faith is not a backup strategy.
This brings us back to Daniel's original frustration with hardware. He was replacing failed components and realizing that each replacement introduced new firmware versions, new manufacturing batches, new potential incompatibilities. The hardware layer was demanding more and more of his attention, while providing less and less confidence. The Ezra model says, "Stop trying to make the hardware perfect. Make the data survivable." Accept that any given machine will fail, and build your resilience at the data distribution layer instead. That's a philosophical shift as much as a technical one. It's the difference between trying to build an unsinkable ship and accepting that all ships sink, so you'd better have enough lifeboats, and they'd better be on different oceans.
There's a humility in that approach that I find appealing. You're not trying to out-engineer entropy at the physical layer, you're acknowledging that entropy always wins at the physical layer, and you're building a system where that's okay. The Torah scrolls didn't survive because they were made of indestructible material. They survived because there were always more copies than could be destroyed. The parchment was fragile. The ink was fragile. The storage conditions were often terrible. But the system was robust because it didn't depend on any single physical artifact. And I think that's the deepest insight here. Robustness isn't about making individual components stronger. It's about making the network smarter than any of its nodes.
Ask yourself this. Would your backup survive an actual targeted boot burning? If someone with a list of every device you own and every cloud account you control decided to eliminate your data, could they? If the answer is yes, you don't have a backup strategy. You have a convenience strategy that happens to protect against drive failure. Ezra was designing against the equivalent of a state-sponsored data destruction campaign, and his architecture held for 2,500 years. That's the benchmark. That's the standard we should be measuring ourselves against, and most of us, myself included, for years, aren't even close.
On that note, I think we've earned a brief tangent that ties back beautifully. There's a fascinating parallel in the natural world, the Atacama Desert Octopus, which was only recently described from fossil evidence. Paleobiologists working in the Atacama found pigment traces suggesting a species of octopus that adapted to transient desert pools during wet periods, then entered extreme cryptobiosis during dry periods that could last decades. The survival strategy wasn't a tougher organism. It was a life cycle timed to environmental cycles, with eggs that could remain viable through conditions that would kill any adult. The species persisted not by being indestructible, but by distributing its reproductive potential across time. Ezra distributed across space. The principle is the same. Don't bet on any single point in space or time. Spread the data. Spread the eggs. Spread the scrolls. Resilience is a function of distribution, not durability.
That's a beautiful image to end on. Ezra the Scribe and the Atacama Octopus, united in distributed resilience, two completely different domains, two completely different timescales, the exact same architectural principle. Daniel, thank you for the prompt. It's changed how I think about what a backup is. To our listeners, check your backups, then verify them, then put a copy somewhere that a fire in your building couldn't reach. The scribes figured this out in the 5th century BCE. We have no excuse.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman.
I'm Korn. Thanks for listening.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.